Corinthians 5, 2 Corinthians 5. Are we running on the... So I don't know if what we're going to do here today is technically legal, because we're going to film the lesson, including the parts of the lesson that I show on the TV. But we have purchased the material, all the material the church has bought. We've purchased all of it, so we've, you know, we're not like bootlegging information or anything like that, but I'm gonna have, when we get to the video portion, I'm gonna have Caleb turn and get that down, because I'm gonna be stopping it a few times and then discussing a couple things that he says a little bit more detail as it pertains to us, okay? So 2 Corinthians chapter 5 verse 20. So as you know, since really the first of the year, we've been talking about issues of ambassadorship and evangelism and the gospel and a lot of these kinds of things. Tom did a presentation on the sales process and how that relates to evangelism 2 weeks ago. So that was good and also interesting and helpful. We're in verse 20. Now that we are ambassadors for Christ, as though God did beseech you by us, we pray you in Christ's stead be reconciled to God. So what we're going to do today is kind of an amalgamation of a lot of different things. So what we have elected to do for the summer, at least as long as it takes, is to go through and discuss this book, Tactics, by Gregory Kukul. The subtitle of this book is A Game Plan for Discussing Your Christian Convictions. This book was written in 2009. I bought it back in 2009, shortly after it came out, and read it with a lot of fascination for the approach that he was taking, okay? The approach of this book is really a tactical approach of how to engage people in conversation around the issues of the gospel and the issues of just Christian conviction in general. Now, we're going to apply it also to the word rightly divided and some other things, but there's some good strategies and tactics that he lays out in the book that we're going to be looking at, okay? And I also purchased the video curriculum that goes along with this. So I bought a set. This is a guide to effectively discussing your Christian convictions. This is the study guide that goes along with the video. So we're going to be following this over the next few weeks. There's 6 videos on here, but I'm thinking some of this we might take a look at a little bit more. I also was telling you not long ago about a book that I had at one point and loaned out and never got it back, and that's called Why Good Arguments Often Fail. So I also repurchased this, and I'm going to be using this periodically to supplement some of the things that Kukul is going to be bringing up in Tactics, okay? So I think I got to everybody, or most of you, and asked you to read chapters 1 through 2 before you came to class today. Ideally, I would have had you read chapter 3 too, but I didn't think he got that far in the first session, but apparently he does. So we'll get to all of that later. So in the study guide here that comes with the DVD, there are some interesting scenarios and things that he gives you to kind of go along with this. So I want to start. Before I do, let me just say, this man is not a mid-Acts Pauline dispensationalist. He does not use the King James Bible. Okay, so obviously, when it comes to the issue of the Bible that he's using, and when it comes to the issue, I haven't seen anything in the first one that I thought was necessarily objectionable or anything along those lines. But I'm going to be using this material as a guide and then interjecting into it sort of how I think this relates to or pertains to us. Okay, so we're not just going to go straight up off of what he says. We're going to be looking at some different things and trying to make some connections here for how we should think about some of these tactics. Okay, so I want to start here. Here's the discussion question, all right? When I think about discussing Christianity with non-believers, I, A, relish the encounter, B, am willing but nervous and uncertain, C, it scares me but I try anyway, or D, I try to avoid it. So let me read those again. When I'm discussing Christianity with non-believers, I A, relish the encounter, B, am willing but nervous Am willing, but nervous and uncertain. C, it scares me, but I try anyway. D, I try to avoid it. So I'm not going to like call on everybody, but is there anybody that wants to like kind of share with us, if you're being honest, which one of those you fall into? A, you relish the encounter. B, I'm willing but nervous and uncertain. C, it scares me, but I try anyway. Or D, I try to avoid it. Fred?
Honestly speaking, it depends a lot on the persona of the other person.
Okay, what do you mean by that?
Well, if the person comes across to me as someone who's open, then I relish the idea.
Okay.
If they come across as one who is, at the opposite extreme, then I approach it with fear and trembling, I guess I would say.
Okay. Appreciate your honesty. Anybody else? Sean?
I think most of the time I lack in your confidence because I'm kind of concerned that I might not have the right details to be able to answer the questions that they have or that arise. Just the references in the Bible, I think, is where I struggle the most. And that's where I get concerned that if it comes to that point in the conversation, that I wouldn't be able to lead them through in that aspect.
Okay, so if I'm hearing you right, I'm hearing you say that you're more worried that you don't have the proper knowledge or the right process or both.
I think it's more of the knowledge and the references back in the Bible and being able to walk through that process if the conversation gets to that point.
Okay. Appreciate that. Anybody else? So A, you relish the encounter. B, willing but nervous and uncertain. C, it scares me, but I do it anyway, or try anyway, excuse me. Or D, I try to avoid it. I think if I'm being honest, I'm with Fred. I think a lot of it sometimes depends on the circumstances, the situation, who I'm with, what else is going on, who's involved, those kinds of things I think are all things that possibly concern us. So what Kukul is basically asserting here in chapters 1 and 2 is a few things. Number one, he says that people go to conferences, they go to church, they get all this stuff, and they get all this knowledge, but what is lacking in the instruction is a practical approach for how to deal with people with that material or with that information. Okay? And so he's going to make a difference between strategy and tactics, as we're going to see here in a minute. Before we get into the video, did anybody have any particular observations or thoughts after reading chapter 1 and 2 this week, or any questions specific that you want to mention? It may be that it's better to go over that later, because he might cover some of it here in the DVD. But before we get started, did anybody have anything they wanted to mention or bring up that you read that you found particularly interesting or that you had a question about?
Not a question. I just thought, you know, we already kind of studied in our evangelistic classes that one water, one soap, and they've got to be an increase, so it's not like putting the whole, takes the burden off of us. We have to think, I got to do it. I got to be perfect. Got to say this right. You know, do what I can, and what got to do the rest. I kind of like that. That takes the whole lot of burden off. We ain't the one that does it yet, and that's kind of cool.
Yeah, and that's a good point. He's going to get into that here. Okay. So, go ahead. Were you done? I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off. All right. So, let's start watching this. There's a couple times where I'm going to stop it. So, this first session it covers basically chapter 1, chapter 2, and chapter 3. So, we'll get into this here, and then I'm going to stop it a couple times and make some comments.
Welcome to the class. I am thrilled that you're taking this class for a very important reason. I think you may very well look back on this particular time that you spent with me and this tactics class as a turning point in your life, that is, at a time when everything changed for you in the way you engage other people about the gospel of Christ. This is what happened to me 10 or 15 years ago when I began to use these tactics more effectively, and I have taught this to thousands of people, literally, and everywhere I go, people come back to me and they tell me, this changed my life. This training, this teaching, this approach to engaging people with the claims of Christ has absolutely changed my life. So I have a great expectation that this is going to be the same for you. And so I encourage you, don't miss a single session if you're going to do this as a group. This is that important. Now, the reason that you're going to be a different person, things are going to change for you because of this course, is because I'm going to provide for you something that has been missing in your training so far. I get a chance to speak at a lot of conferences. There are conferences where a lot of people go to them, and a lot of smart guys are doing the teaching, okay? And they bring lots and lots of good information, and that's fabulous. We need it. And in fact, there's hardly a challenge that has been made on Christianity that hasn't been addressed by some really thoughtful person and dealt with, so we don't have to be afraid of anything. But there's a problem with these conferences, and the problem is, well, it reminds me of the Far Side cartoon where the guy's in a class, and it's a math class, and all the equations are on the board, and the student raises his hand and says, "Professor, can I please be excused? My brain is full." You ever had that situation where you're just overwhelmed with all of the information? It's great, the information that's being given, but there's something missing. And the thing that's missing is a bridge.
So I just want to stop it there. How many of you can relate to that? You come to church, you go to Bible conference, whether it's our conference or somewhere else, and you go and you just get all this information and you get filled up as far as your knowledge goes, probably more than you can possibly comprehend. Like, you really can't squeeze another thing in there. And then you leave and you're sort of like, okay, what do I do with this? Okay. How many of you have had that sort of experience, if you will, right? I know I have, all right? So what he's saying here is, what's often missing is the tactical approach of how to talk to people about this information.
From the content to the conversation. A bridge from the scholarship to the relationship. How do you take all of that stuff that you've been learning and get it in play in a productive way in a conversation? And that is the missing piece that I want to give you in our time together. So here's what I have in mind for our first session together. First, I want to define tactics. I want to tell you what they are, how they're used, and I want to warn you about a danger in using a tactical approach. Okay. The second thing that I want to do is I want to suggest a significant change in the way you approach what we usually call evangelism. Okay. A different way of looking at it. The third thing I want to do is I want to introduce you to the first and the most powerful apologetics tactic, the one that really is the very core of our game plan. And what I'd like to accomplish in the process is not to just give you more information. I want to make a contribution in your life to help produce a certain type of person. Now, I call that an ambassador for Christ. An ambassador for Christ is somebody who has three essential skills. First of all, they know some things. Every ambassador has to have a basic knowledge of the thing that the sovereign wants to communicate through that ambassador, okay? So they need knowledge, an accurately informed mind, okay? But it's not just enough to have the knowledge. They have to have a means of communicating that knowledge that is effective. So I call that wisdom, an artful method. But if you have the knowledge and you have the method, but it turns out you're a drunk or a womanizer or just plain rude, you can see now how a person's character is going to undermine the message. So the third issue is character. You have to have...
So I just want to stop it there. What do you guys think of those as being the three essential skills of an ambassador? So you have... So this is on page... In your book, this is on... this is on page 24 and 25. Okay? On page 24 and 25. So he starts off with knowledge, right? And he says, well, you have to have what? You have to have knowledge. So turn with me in your Bible. I want you to get Colossians 1. Get Colossians chapter 1. Now, some years ago, I did a whole series of studies here at the church called Praying the Powerful Prayers of Paul. And all we did was we studied the way Paul prayed as an example to us, right? So you think about how Paul prays, and you think about what he just said. Now, he's not saying it exactly the same way I'm saying it. He says the three essential skills to a 21st century ambassador: knowledge, wisdom, and character, right? If you look at what Paul prays, Look at Colossians chapter 1, look at verse 9. He says, "For this cause we also, since the day we heard it, do not cease to pray for you." Okay, now watch. "To desire that you might be, that ye might be what?
Filled."
Filled with what?
Knowledge.
"Filled with the knowledge of His will in all" what?
"Wisdom
and spiritual understanding." What is Paul's prayer for the Colossians? His prayer is that they would be filled with the what? First, the knowledge of His will. So Paul says they have to what? They have to know some stuff, right? Then he says in the verse, he says, "And do not cease to pray for you that you, and desire that you might be filled with the knowledge of His will." Then watch, "in all" what?
Wisdom,
right? So this is your knowledge. This is you knowing stuff. So I'm going to be real technical about this. So this is knowing stuff. What is wisdom then? Wisdom is the ability to apply what you know. Now that's Paul's prayer for the Colossians, right? So I don't think he's very far off base, right? You think about what Paul's talking about, and he's saying that he's saying these two things. Let's go on. Yeah, Nate.
Verse 10 is the purpose of.
Yeah, and I was getting into that. Verse 10, "that ye might walk" how? Well, what's that?
Character.
That's your character, right? That's your what? That's your walk. All three of those, Paul's praying on behalf of the Colossians. Verse 10, "that ye might walk worthy of the Lord unto all pleasing, being fruitful in every good work, and increasing in the knowledge of God, strengthened with all might, according to His glorious power, unto all patience and long-suffering with joyfulness." This is really all still the same prayer, by the way. "Giving thanks unto the Father, which hath made us meet to be partakers of the inheritance of the saints in light," and so forth, right? So, three essential skills of an ambassador. Number one, you have to know what's going on. He said it, Kuchel said it, you have to know what the plan of the sovereign is that you represent, right? So we have to know what God's doing today in the world, right? He's saving men by grace through faith. We are living in the dispensation of grace. You need to have wisdom, second, to be able to apply what you know, right? And then you have the character, or you have the walk that's going to follow from those, and that's what he's identifying. So does anybody have any questions or comments about that before we move on with the video? So do we all see that what he's saying in those three points seems to make sense as far as conducting ourselves as ambassadors?
An attractive manner. This course focuses in principally on the second element of being a good ambassador, the tactical skill of engaging people in conversation. So let me pause for a moment and talk about the difference between tactics and strategy. You hear these terms being used in military circumstances and conversations and the like. There is a difference between the two of them, and especially as we engage other people with the claims of Christ, we want to think of these two different things. Strategy kind of involves the big picture. And the way I look at that with regards to our circumstances as Christians is the big picture involves all of the information that we have to make our case. Whether we are defending against a challenge to Christianity, we call it sometimes defensive apologetics or negative apologetics, if you will, or whether we're making a positive case for Christianity, and some call that positive apologetics, in either case, we have the goods. We have the best content, the best information. We have the best worldview, the one that makes the best sense of reality. And so we have the goods. That's the big picture. But how do we get the goods into play in a conversation with people? And this is what I was talking about a few moments ago when I talked about the bridge. Well, this is where tactics come in. Because tactics, simply put, are about how we take those resources that we have at our disposal and we put them into play to maneuver in conversations. Now, I got to offer a warning here because there is a downside here. These tactics are very, very powerful. That means that you can use these tactics if you have ill will to make people look foolish and stupid and that kind of thing. And this isn't the purpose. Tactics are not tricks. They are not slick ruses. They are not clever ploys to destroy non-Christians or force them to submit to your own point of view. They are not attempts to belittle or humiliate or to gain notches in our spiritual belts. This is not what we're about. This is not our spirit here. Okay? Instead, what I
So I want to go to 1 Timothy chapter 2. Along the lines of thinking about the difference between strategy and tactics. Now, this discussion, he has this discussion on page. It kind of goes a little bit different order. This stuff is in chapter 1, where he's talking about the difference between tactics and strategy. Okay, so when I was taking my master's degree in military history, I had an entire class bored me to death about the history of military tactics and strategy. Okay? So we had to read page after page after page of military theorists talking about how to conquer someone. Alright? And they just go on and on and on, right? And I had to take, and in that class we looked at the so-called Western way of war versus the so-called Eastern way of war. Alright? And whether or not, and the point was to think through whether or not there was a cultural difference between how Western Europeans approached warfare versus how, say, people of Asian descent approached warfare, right? So you've all probably heard of the book by Sun Tzu, The Art of War. I mean, you've heard of that book. You might not have read it, but you probably have heard of it, right? Well, we had to read that book as well as all these other things, and it was very interesting, right? So when you read the Asian military theorists, and I'm not saying this in any way to be uncharitable or unkind to Asians, they thought of it a lot differently, okay? They would make a statement in their book, something along the lines of, if your enemy is united, divide him. And that's it. That's all they would say, okay? Whereas when you read the Western stuff, they would go on for page after page after page after page of explaining how to do that. Okay? Now, you think about strategy as the big picture. Look at 2 Timothy chapter 2. Okay? If strategy is the big picture, here is the strategy. Verse 4. Who will have all men to be what?
Saved.
Saved. What are the two things God wants?
Saved.
He wants all men to be what?
Saved.
And what's the second thing in that verse he wants?
Come to the knowledge of truth.
He wants them to come to the knowledge of what?
Truth.
So as we think about our role as ambassadors, what is the strategy that we're trying to accomplish? We're trying to accomplish, number one, to have all men be what?
Saved.
And what? Once they're saved, then what? Then we want them to come to the knowledge of the truth, right? So what are some things under strategy that would entail, okay? Well, that entails Paul's what? That entails Paul's gospel, right? That entails understanding the mystery. That entails understanding some dispensational truth. I'm going to include here, that's going to include issues related to the Bible. What Bible? I'm going to include in that, for us, the issue of the King James Bible. Then fourth, I'm going to include here the issues of the grace life. Idea of total forgiveness. Some of these issues related to intervention, how God's working today, right? So when we think about the strategy as the big picture of what we're trying to be accomplishing as ambassadors. Paul's telling you what that is there in 1 Timothy. It's essentially two issues. It's number one, to have all men be what?
Saved.
Number two is to have people come to the knowledge of what?
Truth.
The truth, right? So that's the big picture. These are things that you're going to need to have in your working what?
Knowledge.
Right? You're going to need to know Paul. You need to know Paul's gospel. You need to know issues about the mystery and dispensational truth. You're going to need to know things about the Bible in general and be able to defend specifically what you believe about the King James Bible. You need to have it. You need to have in your frame of reference an understanding of the grace life and total forgiveness and intervention and who you are in Christ. I add that here, identity-based living and so forth, right? All of these things are going to be part of your working knowledge framework under the category of what? Strategy, right? So then what is tactics going to be? Tactics is going to be figuring out, okay, who am I dealing with? Is the person I'm dealing with, do they need to be what?
Saved.
Is the person that I'm dealing with, are they already saved and do they need to come to what?
Realization.
the knowledge of the truth, right? So the tactics is going to be, how are you going to utilize this information to be an effective ambassador and accomplish the strategy of having all men be saved and come to the knowledge of the truth? So what I'm doing here with this is I'm taking some of the stuff that Kukul is bringing up, and I'm trying to make specific application to us today as members of the Church, the body of Christ, living in the dispensation of grace, right? So all of this, this is all important knowledge that we need to have, right? About ourselves, about who we are, about how we got saved, about our security, about our future, about our hope. All of those things would fit here under this, right? So the tactics are going to be designed to help us ascertain what is our given objective in a particular situation, right? Are we dealing with somebody that needs to be saved? Are we dealing with somebody that needs to come to the knowledge of what? The truth, right? So, does that make sense? Does anybody have any questions about that? Fred?
Yeah, it makes sense. I think one of the things we have to be careful of is don't put the cart before the horse. If a person is ascertained that he's not saved, work toward that objective before getting into...
I agree. That's what I'm saying, right? So as you encounter a person, you have to figure out where does this person fit? Is this a believer who's confused?
Right.
Or is this an
unsafe person.
An unsafe person, right? So once I've ascertained that, is that going to impact how I go about dealing with that person? Okay? There are a lot of people who are saved people who don't understand anything about their identity, don't understand anything about total forgiveness, don't understand anything about intervention. And these types of things. Or we could throw in here the will of God, or a bunch of other practical, or prayer, or a bunch of other practical topics, right? So all of this is going to form your knowledge base, okay? The stuff that believers... So all this information is, going back to what he said in the video, all this information is typically imparted at Bible, at church, and Bible conferences, and that kind of thing, right? But then you leave without any discussion of what? The tactics of how to do it. Okay? That's kind of what he's getting at. So other than Fred, did anybody have a question or a comment? Okay, let's look at the next section.
Teaching you are tactical maneuvers and conversations that will actually help you to manage the conversation. Not to manipulate people. It'll help control the circumstances that you're in. Not coerce-proof people. We're not forcing our views. We're offering arguments. We're seeking to persuade people. Okay? We want to finesse them, not fight with them. All right? We want to use our tactics to maneuver and navigate to the minefields that we invariably are going to encounter when we're talking with other people about our convictions. Basically, the point of the tactical approach is to put you in the driver's seat. Okay? We'll revisit that notion a number of times. But I want to teach you a technique that will allow you to stay in the driver's seat yourself. So now we know what tactics are and what they're not. And I want to talk next about an insight that has completely changed my approach to conversation with other people. A number of years ago, after having, you know, long seasons of frustrating engagements with others, it became clear to me that I was using the wrong approach. And the insight that helped me out here was simply this. Before there can be any harvest, there's always got to be a season of, let's just call it gardening, okay? And this is so important, I want to repeat it. Before there can be any harvest, there always has to be a season of gardening. And you think about it, virtually no one anymore goes from 0 to 60 overnight. They don't get introduced to the gospel and then become a Christian right away. That almost never happens, especially in our communities right now. Those kinds of important decisions take lots of time. And I want you to think about what Jesus said in John chapter 4. This is the woman at the well, and it's a very popular passage, and it's a great conversation Jesus has. But sometimes we miss what he said afterwards. And in fact, it was about a year and a half I was reading this passage, and all of a sudden it jumped out to me. This other part, and how well it fit into what I'm talking about here. Jesus had talked to the woman at the well. She went off to Sychar to tell everybody what this man had told her, bring them to see him. The disciples came, they were out getting food. Jesus says to them, you are about to reap when you did not sow. In other words, there are other people who did the heavy lifting, you're going to get the easy pickings. He said, and in fact, he said, you say there are 6 months or 4 months and then comes the harvest. He said, look, the field is ripe for harvest. He's probably indicating that particular field. I don't think he meant that every field is always ripe for harvest, but that field was. And he's probably referring to the white roses coming across the field right then, being led by the woman at the well. And then he says this, so that the one who reaps and the one who sows can rejoice together. Do you see that? There are two different kinds of workers. There are sowers and there are reapers. There are two different seasons. There are sowing, gardening, if you will, and reaping. But there's one team. And frankly, when I look back at my life, I realize that I've really been a gardener most of my life, whether it's with radio or TV interviews or lectures or what I do in my public presentations. I'm gardening. I'm not harvesting. That's not my skill. And some of you are frustrated because you realize, boy, harvesting is what it's all about. That's what you think. That's the model of evangelism that we've received. But we're in a period of our time now where people need a lot more time during the gardening phase before they're ripe and ready to harvest. And when they're ready, of course, the harvest is easy because you bump up against the fruit and it drops into the basket. That's simple. The hard work is in the gardening. And since we probably need more gardeners than we need more harvesters, chances are pretty good that you are not a harvester, you're a gardener. And you get frustrated because you're not a good harvester, you're not good at closing the deal. It makes you nervous, and I understand that. And so you sit on the bench, and you're not involved. You didn't realize that maybe you're just a gardener, and that's the role that you play. Harvesting is easy when the fruit is ripe. It's part of our job, as is part of our team, to do the gardening. Okay? So I'm a gardener. I'm not a harvester. I suspect most of you are as well. And as such, understanding that there's always a season of gardening that's necessary before the harvest, I have modified my own goal. My goal when I go out is not to try to win that verse to Christ. And it may not even be to get to the gospel. Because sometimes there's all kinds of stuff that have to be dealt with before people will take the gospel seriously. I have a different goal. And I encourage you to adopt the same goal. What is that goal? So, whenever I speak to a non-Christian audience, I have a different goal in mind. And I let them know this goal right up front. I say to them, I'm here tonight because my life has been deeply changed by an ancient teacher. His name is Jesus of Nazareth. And 40 years ago or so, when I was a student at UCLA, I began to think about the claims that Jesus made about himself, about the nature of the world, and the claims that he made on my own life. And I began to ask a lot of questions, and I even pushed back quite a bit too, but finally I came to the conclusion that Jesus got it right. This is what I tell him. And so I began to follow him. Now I say, I'm not here today to convert you. That's not my goal. I just want to put a stone in your shoe. I just want to annoy you in a good way. And they all start laughing when I say this, because they expect the Christian to annoy them. So I say, okay, I'm your guy. But you're going to thank me for it. I just want you walking out of the auditorium tonight, kind of something I said bothering you, sticking at you. I want you to see that Christianity is worth thinking about. And if I can put that stone in their shoe in the lecture that follows, then I'm happy. I'm going to do a little gardening because I know that we've got a whole team of people and a lot of them are gardeners. And I'm going to do a little, you do a little, others do a little, and then when the fruit is ready to be harvested, God's going to bring a harvester, somebody who's capable, into their lives to accomplish that particular goal. So,
all right, so get 1 Corinthians 3 and 2 Timothy 4. So, Bill, you kind of brought this up a little bit at the beginning of the lesson. What do you make of what he's saying about if you could accomplish this, then you've done something good? Okay, this could be a controversial thing to me, of how you think about this. I can conceive that there might be some believers who are like, no, you need to be pressing for a decision every time you encounter somebody, and you know, seeking to be a closer every time that you have a conversation with somebody about the truth. What he's saying, and the way I understand him, and the way I understood it when I read the book almost 10 years ago, was, listen, if you give them something to think about that they cannot ignore, the chances of them coming back to you to find out more information are extremely high, even if you in a given conversation cannot or don't have time, or the circumstances won't allow for you to take them all the way through, you need to at least have the goal of giving them something to think about. Okay? So Bill, what do you make of that? Do you agree with that? Do you disagree with it? I mean, I'm not saying that's the gospel truth or whatever. It's this man's idea. So what do you think about that?
Well, see, that's what most of you are right. I think most people do. You know, like you say, I trust in the death, burial, and resurrection of Christ. And that he's my Lord and Savior. He paid for all my sins. Thank God. But sometimes people want to hear something before that. Well, you know, however, just they say all I heard is crap, or they just don't like Christians because of the way they live.
Okay.
I think it's a good way. Something to remember. We'll catch you all.
Sean?
I think from observations and from people that I've talked to in the past, when somebody goes out with that goal of getting the decision, they're more forceful, and people quite often are just saying okay to get them off, to get somebody off their back. Not that their heart's in it anymore, not that they're really convinced, but I think a lot of people at that point kind of, for lack of a better term, backslide and don't really pursue and don't really have their heart in to following up and actually investigating what's been presented to them.
So if I'm hearing what you're saying accurately, you're saying that if you come, that a lot of people just tell you what they think you want to hear to get rid of you. Is that what you're saying?
When a person goes in with that goal of getting that decision, I think a lot of times they get to the point where they annoy people to an extent that they'll just give in to whatever you're presenting to them.
Okay.
Yeah.
Nate?
Well, I think a great example of that is Fred and Cody. You know, he worked with him for quite a while. I mean, I'm sure he's talked to you a couple times during that process, but you know, he came and talked to me a few times about it, and Fred built a relationship with that young man, and over the course of weeks and even months, that you worked with Cody, over the course of weeks and months, finally, you know, just gave him a little bit at a time, and talked with him, and then eventually he got to that point where he made the decision. It didn't happen the day he met him.
So the idea, adopting what he's saying, and the other, so let's just read a couple of verses here. 1 Corinthians 3, we've read this before, and Bill already alluded to it, verse 5. Who then is Paul, and who is Apollos, but ministers by whom ye believed, even as the Lord gave to every man? I have planted, and Apollos watered, but God gave the increase, right? So there's his illustration of the activity of what? Gardening, right? Planting and watering is the activity of doing the gardening, right? Tending to the seed, right? Verse 7, so neither is he that planteth anything, neither he that watereth, but God that giveth the increase, right? Now he that planteth and he that watereth are one, and every man shall receive his own reward according to his own labor. So there's obviously a lot of things we could get into there, but the concept of what he's talking about is there. Another scripture that came to mind as I was doing some prep for this week is what Paul says in 2 Timothy 4 verse 1 or verse 2, where he says, preach the word, be instant in season and what? Out of season, right? So, you know, so let me just share with you the big catastrophe at our house this week. The big catastrophe at our house this week was we are moving the horse to our property and the realization that we don't have any hay. Okay? So I don't know nothing about hay. I know absolutely nothing about hay. So now this week I learned that there are three cuttings that each cutting has different quality hay of the nutrients that are in the hay. I learned all this stuff, right? Because now we've got to go and buy hay for the horse, right? And I've learned that there's a late spring, early summer harvesting of the hay, which is happening now. Then there's a late summer, mid to late, or later summer, late August, early September harvesting of hay. And then there is a fall harvesting of the hay. And every time, same hay field, same everything, every time you harvest the hay, you get a different, the quality of the nutrients in the hay is different depending on what time of year you harvest it, right? Okay? So I'm thinking about all this in relationship to what I'm studying to prepare for this lesson, and I'm thinking, that's interesting, right? So I drive by, I don't know how many times I've driven by a hayfield and not even realized it was a hayfield, but now I know, and so now I'm like, hey, there's a hayfield over there, I didn't even know that was there. Okay? You just become aware of things. It's like when you buy a new car, right? So when I bought a Subaru, I started noticing everybody else on the road that had a Subaru. Never paid attention to it before, but now all of a sudden I'm aware of it, right? My point is, when Paul says, preach the word, be instant in season and out of season, there's that reality, right? You don't know. Your job as an ambassador is to know the truth and give people what? The truth, right? You don't know where they are at individually in that process, okay? So, the idea of putting a stone in the shoe, I'm curious as a sort of follow-up question. Does adopting that approach take the pressure off? And if the pressure is taken off, does it make you more willing to engage in the process of ambassadorship? Okay? So, does anybody have any feedback on that? Or thoughts on that?
I find it a lot easier because sometimes it's just a quick, short conversation. It's not a long, drawn out. You don't need to set aside time for this. You can have just some quick, short, somebody you'll engage again later, but just some quick, short information, something just to get them thinking.
So you don't need to have a church council meeting every time you talk to somebody.
Right.
Okay. Anybody else? All right, now he's going to finish this point up and start getting into the tactics.
I want you to think about changing your goal, not to get him to sign out the dotted line, but just to do a little gardening, just to put a stone in their shoe. Okay? So I have something that you don't have that makes all the difference. I have a game plan. And that's the game plan that I would like to share with you during this course. And here's the promise that I'm going to give you. In this course, I am going to give you a game plan that will allow you to converse with confidence in any situation, no matter how little you know, or how knowledgeable, or aggressive, or even obnoxious the other person may be. Okay? It's a game plan that I ordered in a very particular way to make it simple to follow, yet is tailor-made for each individual. It follows Paul's directions in Colossians chapter 4, verse 5 and 6, and here's what he says there. He says, conduct yourselves with wisdom towards outsiders, making the most of the opportunity. So first he says, be smart, all right? Second, he says, let your speech always be with grace, seasoned as it were with salt. Be nice. How about that? Be smart, be nice. What a concept. Third thing he says, so that you know how to respond to each person.
All right, I just want to read that quick out of the King James. Colossians 4, look at what he says, verse 5. So he starts off there and he says, walk in wisdom. Okay, so what would that be? Of these three things here, what would that be? Knowledge, wisdom, or character? It would be both, right? It would be walking with what? With wisdom, right? So he says, walk in wisdom toward them that are without. Who's that? That's the person, that's a non-believer. That's the person that's not part of the assembly, right? That's the person that's not a part of what's going on in the church in Colossae. Walk in wisdom to them that are without, redeeming what? The time. Okay? Redeeming the time. Let your speech, that's related to this. That's related to how are you going to engage people. He says, let your speech be always with grace, seasoned with salt, that ye may know how ye ought to answer every man. Okay? Now, I'm going to say this to you right now. Paul practiced apologetics. He says right there in that verse, that ye may know how ye ought to answer what? Does Paul anticipate that as a believer, you're going to receive objections? Does Paul anticipate, as a believer, people are going to have questions, and that it's going to be your job as an ambassador to know how to answer them? Okay? So even though we're using this curriculum and we're kind of going through this and I'm sort of slotting stuff in here where I feel it's appropriate and beneficial, the idea behind this is not something that is foreign to what Paul did and what Paul is instructing the Colossians here. He says again, verse 6, "Let your speech be always with grace, seasoned with salt, that ye may know how ye ought to answer every man." So people are going to have questions, they're going to have objections, they're going to have things that they want clarified, and now he's going to get into the first tactic of Columbo.
Be tactical. Be smart. Be nice. Be tactical. Now let me give you an example of what I mean about employing this kind of tactical approach, trying to put a stone in someone's shoe, not going for the gold, but following Paul's advice there in Colossians chapter 4. A number of years ago, I was having a conversation with a young lady in a film place. My wife and I, this is before our digital days, we were having some film produced, and I noticed that there was a pentagram hanging from her neck. Now, a pentagram is a five-pointed star. It's usually an occultic symbol, but I wasn't exactly sure what it meant for her, so I asked her. I said, "Does that jewelry have religious significance?" And she said, "Yes, it does. The 5 points stand for earth, wind, fire, water, and spirit." So, okay, I've heard this before. I wanted to know whether it really had religious significance for her, and I asked her that question. She said, "Yes, I'm a pagan." Now, I'm a trained professional, so I'm, you know, cool and calm. My wife never heard that before. When she heard the lady refer to herself as a pagan, my wife started to chuckle, and then she caught herself, and she said, "I'm sorry, I didn't mean to be rude. I just never heard anybody admit it before." She'd only heard the word pagan used when her girlfriends would call her kids and, you know, "Get in here, what's a pagan?" kind of thing. But the woman wasn't offended. She said, "Well, no, this is a earth religion." And she began to explain how in her earth religion, they respect nature and life and the like. And I realized that the woman I was talking probably to a witch. And so I asked her, "Are you Wiccan?" And she said, "Yes, I am." And then repeated this notion about respecting all life. Now, I know a little bit about witchcraft, and they do respect life, and that means that most of the time they're pro-life with regards to the abortion issue. So I asked her that. "Are you pro-life with regards to the abortion issue?" She said, "No, I'm pro-choice." I said, "Isn't that a little bit unusual for a witch to be pro-choice?" And she said, "Yeah, it is." But, and then she said this. She said, "I know I could never do that," referring to abortion. "I could never kill a baby." Now, those were her words. Now, stand the reason we have training material about abortion, and we train people to make the case that abortion kills an innocent human being, maybe killing if you like, but we don't use that kind of language. Because we don't want people to think we're advancing our case by using slick rhetoric, baby killer, that kind of thing. But now I'm not the one who is using that language, it's the witch who is the pro-choicer who's identifying abortion as baby killing. And one thing I hope that you get out of our sessions together is you get the conviction that you have to listen to what people say, because they're going to give you stuff you can use. I'm listening. So am I going to use the word abortion anymore? Do we continue this conversation? No, 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 no. I'm going to talk about baby killing, because she's already legitimized the phrase. She said, I would never do that. I would never kill a baby. And then she said, "Why?" She said, "I wouldn't want anything bad to come back on me." Kind of like a karma thing, you know, what goes around comes around. I don't know about you, but I think that's kind of an odd reason not to kill a baby. I'm not going to kill any. You never know what's going to happen to you when you kill babies, you know. Maybe it's just a good idea not to kill babies. But I didn't take that tack. Instead, I said, "Well, maybe you won't kill babies, but maybe we should stop other people from killing babies." And she said, "Well, I think people should have a choice." Now, what is the choice we're talking about? You're by our own admission. The choice to kill babies, right? And so I asked her that. "You mean they should have a choice to kill babies?" And she said, "Well, you know, I think all things should be taken into consideration." I said, "Okay, well, what would be a good consideration to make it okay to kill a baby?" And she immediately said, "Incest." Now, notice what's going on here. She is trying out all the pro-choice slogans, right? But she's not thinking about it because she's already identified abortion as baby killing, so all of the pro-choice slogans are now slogans in favor of baby killing explicitly. And it's starting to sound a little weird to me, but she doesn't get it because she's just using slogans. People do this all the time. And Christians do this all the time as well. Okay? So I wanted to get her off her stride a little bit. I'm asking questions. Finally, I said, let me see if I understand your view. If I had a two-year-old who was standing next to me right now, who had been conceived by incest, on your view, then I should be allowed to kill this baby. Now, this question stopped her in her tracks. And she thought about it for a moment. And then she said, well, I have mixed feelings about that. Now, she meant it as a concession. I said, I hope so.
So let's just talk about that conversation. This is also, he records... if you want to read it again, he records this on page 20 and 21 about the conversation with the witch in Wisconsin. Well, what did he do in that conversation? Just think about what he just described. What did he do?
He asked her to justify what he
did. All he did was ask her what?
Questions.
That's it. Very simple. He sees the pentagram and he says, oh, what is that? Oh, well, this is my pentagram. It represents da-da-da-da-da. Oh, that's interesting. So does that mean you're a witch? Yes, I'm a witch. She freely admits what? She's a Wiccan. Nope. Okay, well, then he says, well, that's interesting. You know, well, then what do you think about this? And all he has done at this point is simply what? Ask questions. And in asking the questions, has he... put a stone in her shoe about an inconsistency in her thinking. And all he had to do was what?
Ask
the questions. Okay? Now he's going to kind of summarize that, right? Okay? So he's going to kind of go through what the pros and cons of that were.
Next, you know, she said it as a confession. But it got her thinking, and I noticed that the line is growing behind me. Okay? So I realized that now I am interfering with her work product. And had I been of a different conviction, I might say, look at folks, I haven't gotten to the gospel yet. Sit down, listen up, maybe you'll learn something. But I didn't do that. I realized that I'm a gardener. I do what I can. I put a stone in her shoe, and then I move on and trust the rest to the Lord. And that's what I did there. Now, I want you to notice something about that conversation. In that conversation, I asked 9 different questions. I used questions to begin the conversation, to gather information from her. I used questions to explore what I thought was a weakness. I saw her view, her inconsistency. I also tried to show the natural consequences of her view. On her view, I should be allowed to kill this little child who had been conceived by incest. And, I'd like to say she was doing all the work, because I wasn't doing any work. I was relaxed. But it turns out she wasn't doing any work either. She was relaxed. I was relaxed. There was no lines drawn in the sand. There was no dukes up. We weren't fighting each other. This is the power of using a tactical approach. This is exactly the way I want it. Now, stand to reason, we have lots of different tactics. We have tactics with things like steamroller, taking the roof off, and just the fax man, and suicide. But there is one tactic that really is the core of the game plan. It's the best tactic that I've ever used. It can be used with other tactics. But it's the easiest tactic imaginable. To stop a detractor in their tracks, to turn the tables, to get them thinking, and to put you in the driver's seat of the conversation. Remember, that's the place we want to be when we talk about tactics. We want to be in the driver's seat. And the tactic has a name, and the name is Columbo. Named after the famous Lieutenant Columbo, who always showed up at the crime scene wearing a trench coat like this, all wrinkled, messed up, looked like he slept in it, maybe he did, I don't know. I got mine in a Salvation Army, so if you ever get something in a Salvation Army, my wife taught me, always check the pockets, because you never know what you're going to... Wait a minute. Oh my gosh! Look at that! A cigar! See, Lieutenant Columbo, he always has a cigar. Okay, this is just a plastic one, so don't worry. Alright? No problems here. I actually hate cigars. Whenever I find one, I always destroy it. By fire. Completely. I don't want anybody to stumble. Anyway, so Lieutenant Colombo shows up. He also's got a pad of paper, right? But he can't use his pad of paper. Why not? Because he doesn't have a pen or pencil. He's got to bum a pencil off of somebody else, right? And this guy walks around the crime scene, scratching his head, mumbling to himself. He doesn't look like he can think his way out of a wet paper bag. He's stupid, but he's stupid like a fox. Because at some point, He's going to pause. He's got a method to his madness. He's going to pause and rub his brow like he's deep in painful thought and say something like, I don't know. Yeah, something about this thing that bothers me. Do you mind if I ask you a question? And he asks the question, right? And then he gets the answer. You're very intelligent. And one more thing. And then he one more thing from the death, right? With question after question after question. Pretty soon people start getting upset. He says, I'm sorry. It's because I asked all these questions, but I can't help it. It's a habit. And this is a habit that you want to get into. The key to the Colombo tactic is that the Christian goes on the offensive in an inoffensive way with carefully selected questions.
All right. So we're not going to have time to get into the details of that, but that's the Colombo tactic, right? To go on the offensive in an inoffensive way by asking questions. How many of you have seen Colombo? They got reruns on Netflix. So I watched one this week because I'm like, oh, I'm just... It was interesting, I'll say that. So I didn't realize. You realize those were hour and 20 minute episodes? If you watched the Colombo episode, you were in that with the commercials for 2 hours back in the 70s. It was a commitment. Okay? Yeah. But anyway, that's exactly what Colombo does. He walks in and he sort of looks like just, he's disheveled and he's unkempt and his hair's a mess and he's walking around and he comes across as sort of just this bumbling, you know, sort of dummy, if you will, who just has all these questions. But in the meantime, is he extracting a lot of information out of the people without them being threatened by him? Okay? So we're a few minutes to time. How much time we have left on the... Okay, so what I want to do is I'm going to stop it there. I'm going to mark in my thing here exactly where we're at. For next Sunday, I'd like you to read chapter 3, 4, and 5. Okay? So your homework would be to read chapter 3, 4, and 5. So that's the homework. All right? I do want to end though with a scenario, okay? So just a little practice scenario, we can do this together, alright? So thinking about Colombo, thinking about going on the offensive in an inoffensive way by asking questions, suppose that you were in this scenario, the following scenario, okay? The scene. You're at a dinner party at a friend's house with some of your close friends from church. The conversation ranges naturally over a number of interesting spiritual topics. Suddenly, to your surprise and embarrassment, the host's 15-year-old son announces with some belligerence that he doesn't believe in God anymore. It's simply not rational, he says. There is no proof. No one had any idea he'd be moving in this direction. The audience is stunned. The challenge. Your opportunity will pass quickly. You have only a few seconds to initiate further dialogue, but you want to do so in a way that will be productive and will help everyone in the room reflect intelligently on the issue. What will you say? This is under an exercise called 10-second window. It's under the idea that somebody says something and you have a very short amount of time to what?
Respond.
To respond. Okay, now this goes along a little bit with what Lee talked about early, a few months back, about breaking the sound barrier, right? So you're in this scenario, maybe we'll start next Sunday. I'll give you a week to think about it, okay? Give you a whole week to think about your 10-second window, alright? What would you say? Using the tactics, using the Colombo method, even though we haven't studied it all in detail yet, you're at this scenario, you're at this gathering, and somebody says this, you have a short window of opportunity to say something, what are you gonna say? Okay? So I want to start our next class next week by hearing feedback on that question. Does that make sense? Does anybody have any questions or comments or thoughts as we wrap up this lesson?
I think a point that he brought up in the book that he didn't really bring up here is once you engage into an argument that you've already lost your... You've lost either whether they get upset or you get upset. At that point, you've lost any, I guess at that point it's your character that you've lost them as far as being able to engage them.
And when you say an argument, you are meaning a verbal altercation.
Yes.
Right? Where there is shouting, yelling, raised voices, all that sort of thing.
Yes.
And that's a good point, Sean. And one thing I'd add to that is the following. You remember he just went through this scenario with the witch in Wisconsin in the film store? Okay. The other thing that you have to realize is it may be